Hello, hello, hello. Everyone hear me all right?
We can hear you. Please go ahead.
Very good. So it's my pleasure to be here with you today. I do a lot of speaking, and most of it's sort of keynotes and talking about libraries and what we should be doing. But what I thought I could take advantage of today is a slightly different format and a slightly different outcome. I want to talk about brass tacks. I want to talk about some of the things that we can be really practical when we're trying to build initiatives and trying to get buy-in and trying to lead. So this is going to be much more of a how I do things versus sort of a where in the universe that we're going. To that effect, if you have questions throughout, and I told Fred beforehand, ask the questions as we're going. I'm all for being interrupted. I'm always more interested in having conversations than talking at people. So we'll do that. So I'm going to go ahead, and hopefully you're now seeing me in slide mode. Well, you're not seeing me. You're seeing my slides. So once again, thank you. I was going to title this presentation David Lanka Speaking to Llamas, because there was a fabulous tweet that when put it out, they go, I read that as David Lanka's teaching llamas about thought leadership. And I thought that would be an excellent image, but I went with this instead. You know, I don't know if I'm a thought leader or not, but I certainly am sometimes accused of and sometimes given credit for being someone who can at least get conversations started and push ideas ahead. And I see myself very much as a sort of pragmatic utopian, and that is the idea that we're all working towards a better field. We're all working towards a better discipline. We're all working towards better institutions. We're all working to improve the status that we are in and the communities that we serve are in. And to do that, we're sort of utopians. We believe in a better tomorrow. We believe in things that can get better and new services, and we're all ultimately optimists. But we also need to be pragmatists. How do we get those ideas out? How do we share it? We can't do everything on our own. How do we incorporate and bring other people into it? So that's where I wanted to talk about today. And I'm basing this actually on this man's work. This is Bob Dacey. Bob Dacey, at least when I was an undergraduate, taught illustration at Syracuse University. I imagine he still does. And what Bob, the best class I ever took at SU, and there were many good ones, but the best one I ever took was actually not a class. Bob Dacey was a working illustrator. He had a job. He had commissions. And what he would do on Friday afternoons is he would just set up his shop in some studio and do the job, paint for an hour or 2 hours to do the job. And as he was doing this, he'd sort of think aloud as he did it. He'd talk about, well, this is why I'm using this paint. Oh, this is the right paper to use. This is where we're going. And just that immensely practical standpoint of how he did his job was extraordinarily informative. And so once again, rather than trying to give a big speech about the importance of leadership in the future, I thought I'd just give you some sort of tips and techniques about what it is that I do in terms of trying to generate a conversation, trying to get people's attention, trying to move organizations and librarians and folks towards what I consider a better future. And I'm often accused of being a futurist, and it's not true. I'm very much a currentist. I want to change what we're currently doing, not worry about what we're going to be doing in 20 years, because if we don't pay attention to what we're currently doing, we won't be doing anything in 20 years. So that was a lot of preface, but let's get at it. So what I want to talk about is really pragmatic. You're sitting in your office, you're doing your service, you're a professor in a school, you're a student in a school, whatever it is, and you have an idea. Something's bothering you, some concept, some situation is really you're spending a lot of thought time on, right? And so how do we turn that question, that concern, that thought into action? How do we begin to actually bring people around to being part of a solution? So the general model is think about what is the current situation. and a lot of scholarship in academic libraries, in library science, and that you read in journals, even people doing case studies and such in school libraries and public libraries and special libraries. All of this really fits into this bubble about sort of where things are. And we go to a lot of conferences, and a lot of conferences are populated by a lot of "this is what is" presentations, right? Like we go to, and today we're going to talk about Twitter, and today we're going to talk about this technology, today we're going to talk about this. And it's really sort of a briefing on how things are. And how things are important, but it doesn't necessarily inspire people to action. It doesn't really bring and change how people think. Simply describing the current situation is insufficient for action. So it's important to do, but it's insufficient. What we need to do to really begin talking about leading, about moving people, about moving ideas, about moving discussions, is we can't start with, "Hey, this is the situation, what do you think?" Because when you do that, you might get a few loud voices that are willing to share what they think about anything at any time, but it's not necessarily going to be a very inclusive conversation. It's not going to change a lot of minds. It really is just sort of this static, "Okay, that's how it is." So the first thing that you need to do when you're talking about setting an agenda, moving people forward, is you have to say, all right, if this is what's currently going on in technical services, in maker spaces, in user experience design, in LIS education, in whatever it is, project out and say, if nothing changes, if we continue doing what we're doing, this is what the future will look like. This is our anticipated future. And once again, good scholarship, good research, good planning, strategic planning, whether you do SWOT analysis, what have you, is really about this idea of, well, what happens if we don't change? What's going to go on, right? Will there be libraries? Will there be a reference? Will we have collections? Will we need buildings? Will we need et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And once again, a lot of really good work goes into it. What are the variables? How do you analyze them? What are the trends? How do we go out and gather data around it? How do we get input from the community, et cetera? But even this becomes rather fatalistic. It's the idea that this is what the future is. And I'm certainly of the belief that I have no idea what the future is. And in fact, I'm not particularly interested in what everyone thinks the future is. I'm much more interested in what people think the future should be. And so what you need to do is develop a preferred future. In other words, yes, if nothing changes, this is where we go. But we have a chance to change things. In fact, that's the idea of an agenda. If you simply looked at a situation and said, that's what's happening in that situation, that's fine. Great. But if you really want to talk about an agenda, you want to begin to change where things are going, change how we deal with the climate, change how we work in a community, change economic development activities, whatever it is. We need a preferred future. And there will always, always be a gap between the anticipated future and the preferred future. It may be an itty, itty, bitty little gap. Things like, well, if we implement this way of doing shelving, we can shave 15 minutes a week off of our shelving activities. Or it may be huge. Boy, we really need to talk about closing all the libraries so that librarians get jobs in institutions all around the country and are embedded with the people they're serving, and there'll be more librarians, etc. I don't know what your preferred future is. And this doesn't have to be at the massive scale. We'll talk about that later. But you want to have a sense of a preferred future, right? This is the golden city, the city of lights on the hill in the future, the concept of where we want to go. Once you have this preferred future, and I'll tell you as an academic, all too often people who work in empirical data, who look at methodology, who do all of these things, we sort of get squeamish about a preferred future because we feel as librarians, we feel as scholars, we feel as, throw whatever term you want, that we are objective, that in essence, we are only sort of observing what the future is, that we don't get to control it. But the truth is, we get to control it. We decide what that future is. We decide what the emphasis is. And what we're going to talk about for the rest of this is how do we get other people to join into that conversation? Not necessarily agree with us, but at least to join into that conversation. So once we have sort of know the problem and we can define it well, and once we talk about if nothing changes with this problem, this situation, this environment, this is what's going to happen, and then we identify, but we really would like this to happen, we can begin to work backwards so that we can define an agenda. What do we need to do in order to make this preferred future happen? And you can work either way, either from the preferred future back to the present or from the present to the preferred future. I actually find it easier to work from the present forward. But things like, okay, how do we get people to understand this issue the same way we do? How do we get a common definition? How do we get a forum in which we talk about it? How do we draw people's attention? Okay, after we have awareness and definition, how does that turn into the first level of change, and how many people need to be involved, and what are the scales, and et cetera? And so you begin to put together an agenda of change. And I would recommend this, once again, for big things. We want our new public library to go through a major new bond initiative that's going to totally revamp all its branches, and we're going to become more user-centric, and we're going to have more maker spaces, and et cetera. Or it can be really small. We need to talk about how we handle our volunteers on a much better basis. Right now, they're taking a lot of our time, and we're not getting a lot of benefit out of it. What we really need to do is create X, Y, or Z. It works in all those situations. All too often, what I've found in the field, in our field, but frankly, it's not just our field. I've seen it in education and transportation and telecommunications all across the board, is that there's a general unease with our current condition, but rarely is there a sense of direction. How do we get out of the hole that we've dug? And simply by projecting a preferred future out there for discussion, may not be the final one we end up with, but at least the discussion, already you get a lot more positive interactions with the people you work with, work for, or who work for you. The idea that you're seen as someone who's interested in action and moving ahead comes not simply by identifying problems, but by identifying solutions within them. Right, and this is, you throw whatever cheesy used metaphor you want about come to me with solutions, not with problems. But it comes down to we are attracted to people who want to make change. Even if we're not necessarily thrilled with the change they want to make, at least we admire the fact that they're working towards that change. So let me move from that sort of 30,000 foot view of it to talk about some specific methods of building that agenda and bringing people to this conversation. And I'm going to use some examples within, but once again, as you're hearing this, as you have specific problems that you're trying to tackle, as you have ideas that you're trying to work on, bring them up and we can talk about it. So let's start with, what do we need to do to move this forward? What do we need to start a movement? What do we need to create a sort of coalition of the willing to push us forward to that preferred future? The first thing we need to do is build linkable ideas. Not likable, but linkable ideas. What do I mean? I have the great advantage of talking with brilliant people in all walks of life and in all disciplines. And they have some fantastic ideas on how to improve everything from management operations to services we offer to everything. And one of the things that I find over and over again is that people with great ideas tend not to worry about the mechanisms of how other people get access to those ideas. In other words, we think that developing the idea alone is sufficient, but in fact, what we need to do is make those ideas accessible and available to others. So every idea needs a findable home on the web. What does that mean? First of all, name everything. If you're about to redo your volunteer process in a public library, rather than simply saying, so how's that project going? Do everything from giving it the old-fashioned, silly technology name, Project Daedalus is going to engineer this, to simply calling it the new volunteer project, what have you. You need a common name. That means that as you talk to more and more people, and as those people have different levels of engagement and different levels of engagement with your organization, they begin to use common terminology. And that idea of common terminology saves so much time as you move forward. So give things an easy tag to refer folks to, right? It also, on a really tactical level, makes it seem bigger than and more than just you. If you talk about the 21st century volunteerism program, it makes it sound like, ooh, that's an initiative. It must have a budget and a place and a big marble building somewhere, when in fact it may just be you and your friends meeting every Thursday night at a bar. That's fine. But the idea is to give the impression that things are moving along, that there is some structure, because that instantly becomes a sort of value that people are willing to engage in. It's not that you aren't important or you alone aren't important. It's just the idea that you also want to make it seem that the idea is big enough for other people to participate in. If it's just your project, if it's Dave's attempt to fix the morass that is our volunteer program, then it's Dave's. And that's not something that you can become a part of. By creating a name for it that people can remember, it also gives them the ability to adopt that name and adopt that charge. Now, one of the things is, once you get a name, it needs some place on the web. Now you're saying, but Dave, if I'm a library of three people, do I need it on the web? No. Clearly, I'm talking about things that are either in larger organizations or across organizations. But having a place where people can go and find that idea, understand that idea, discuss that idea, participate in that idea, what have you, they need a place. And as the cliche goes, but unfortunately in this case, well, maybe fortunately, it's true. If you're on the web, you don't exist, right? If you didn't publish the paper and you can't find it on an online database or find it in Google, who's going to cite it? You need a place on the web. I personally am still a huge fan of open web, blogs, anything with a URL, versus social media closed gardens. I've seen many, many, many projects that have started with Facebook pages and Facebook groups. And while that can work well, it can also exclude a large number of people. It also makes it really hard, frankly, to find it with open web tools from Google searches and on. So I highly recommend creating a space where on the web you can quickly put up materials, ideas, conversations, things to work on. If the technology scares you, go to WordPress.com and start a free WordPress site. They do a lot of stuff very easily. Wix, a bunch of these different websites where you can create a presence for your project becomes very important. And linkable is not just a matter of being able to put in a URL. It's not just a matter of how HTML works with it. We're also talking about linkable as an invitation to be a part, meaning you always have to say, how do I link other people to my task? How do I bring them in? Right? So you have a brilliant idea. Idea number one, right? We're going to take our volunteers and we're going to turn them from mini librarians doing shelving to we're going to turn them into a core of teachers that are going to come in and offer public programming. All right? We're going to call it the community-oriented volunteerism, or something that preferably has a lovely acronym. We've created a place on the web so people can learn what we're doing, where we're spending our time. And then what we need to do is say, all right, that's a great idea. How can I be involved? Always be ready for the ask. What you're going to run into is you're going to run into people going, oh, that's a great idea. How can I help? Or, that's a fantastic idea. We should do that. What's the next step? Be ready for the ask. People who get excited about things quickly lose excitement when they realize they can't necessarily be involved in it. So are you going to ask them for time? Are you going to ask them for money? Are you going to ask them for expertise? Are you going to ask them for their ideas? Are you going to ask them for their thoughts? Are you going to ask them to come and present somewhere? Are you going to ask them for whatever it is? Be prepared for the ask. Being, once again, tactical to the level of guerrilla warfare tactics, we know that in doing development work, which is a fancy way of saying in institutions where we learn to ask for money, which is just about everything, the number one thing that people screw up when they approach potential donors is they don't have the ask. They're great at talking about what's awesome and what's going on and neat stuff, but they haven't taken the time to actually say, and I need your help to do this. I've talked to many in academia, we talk, well, how would I go up to a donor? I feel silly asking for charity. And I've talked to a consultant who says, well, how do I ask people to pay for my time? You know, I really want to go out and make this happen. Isn't it uncomfortable to talk about money? And the answer is, it's not that you're asking for money. You're asking for resources to implement your idea. Don't give me $100,000 because you think I'm a nice guy. Don't give me $10,000 because you think I'm a nice guy. Give me $10,000 or $100,000 so that I can make this happen that you care about. So that I can take our senior population, the retired population that are living longer and longer with amazing experiences and expertise within our community, and make that available to the new generation that's coming up. Is that interesting? Okay, that's going to take some funding to make it happen. I need that from you. You're not asking them for money because you're nice or charitable or they're going to trust you. You ask them for the idea. So you have to be aware, what would you use that for? Always be ready with the ask. When someone says, oh, that's a great idea, how can I help you? Well, why don't you become one of the volunteers? Hey, I have an idea. Do you have friends that you could bring to a meeting? Whatever it is, be prepared for the ask. Over and over and over again, back to our agenda, when people get stuck in the present and the present is the situation, the first mistake is they don't have a solution. The second is once they have a solution, they don't know how that solution turns into things that people can participate in. It becomes an owned property. It becomes a market of one, and people don't feel they can be included. So it's essential that as you go to implement new ideas, you create ways for people to participate. This is true whether you're working on new tasks or whether you're working on a new assessment system. We're going to, as a university, implement a new way of doing annual assessments. All right, what's the ask? I need an extra year to put this together. I need to understand what the feeling of my staff is. I need these kinds of things. Because the preferred future is we're going to be more agile. What's the ask? How do people get involved in it? How do they learn more about it? How do they refer to it? It's that simple oftentimes when you talk about getting people's attention and building a vision. If you show up at a conference and you say, well, I want to talk about what I did for the past 6 months, and you just start blurting out this happened, then this happened, then this happened, versus I would like to tell you about our expertise in the 21st century initiative and where we did these things, and here's where you can link to find out more information about it. Here's where my slides, we'll talk about that in a second. And have any questions? Oh, you'd like to do this in your own institution? This is what I need. All right. So we have an agenda, and we've begun to identify linkable ideas. What other things can we put in place to begin to move people to build this community around an idea, around a potential solution, to build a movement that pushes forward my organization, my agenda, my field, my community? The next thing we need to do, this is one example. So the example here is that I've been working for a long time to talk about community-based librarianship. That is, where the community is the collection and how we utilize, interact with the community, give community ownership, standard line here, which, by the way, it's important to have a standard line. The question became, all right, how do we begin to then get these ideas so that if someone hears it at a conference or hears it through a tweet or wants to know what's more about it, where do they go? This is expectmorelibrary.com brings you to this page. And so you can, on this page, begin to understand more about the product, more about, there's an ask here. If you take a look at this site, what it's really about doing is it's saying, how do we function as a community? I'm trying to facilitate that conversation to occur. But there's a place on the web, so it exists. It's not just a physical book. It's not just an article in a journal. It's not just a couple of presentations. There's a place for this. Okay, so we have a linkable idea. We have a place on the web, we have a terminology, we have our ask ready. What's next? What's next is something really natural to most of us in the library field, which is we need to begin to build a collection. That is, all right, we have a site on the web, we have a URL, we have a domain, and we have a nice picture. But is there any content there? What content needs to be there? How do we get people engaged? How do they look deeper into this? And we do that by doing what we do in general. We build and curate collections. And what I can tell you is, be very keen to capture everything. To capture everything means I'm capturing right now, I'm using screencast software called ScreenFlow on a Mac to capture a recording of this presentation. Llama, you guys are recording this session as well. Why? Well, yes, because obviously we want people to, oh, what do you say on slide 5? But also now we have content to begin populating that place on the web, that linkable site. We're showing action. We're showing that things are occurring here. We're also providing depth of that information. As you're blogging, as you're taking journal notes, as you're taking meeting notes, how do you capture that information and make it available? There's a concept, I mean, these days everyone's probably heard about the idea of open software or open development. And the idea here is that when we work on software projects, we put up code base, we let other people submit to it, we build a whole team, and we virtually build a piece of software that we can do everything from interlibrary loan to integrated library systems to new social media to whatever it is. right? WordPress began that way. Koa is that way. Evergreen, many examples. But open software is one thing, but it's still exclusionary, right? It opens to programmers and people who understand that world and people who have that language. Take that idea and abstract it up into what I call open effort initiatives. That is, as you're working forward, being transparent and documenting and making it clear to show your formative ideas and not just your final ideas. I think a lot of times we worry that we have to come up with the perfect solution that's been copy edited 3,000 times and has been checked with everyone to see if it offends it, and then we put it up as a done deal. By showing your work, by showing the margins, by showing the scribbles and the false starts and the idea generation and what I call the sort of foment of intellectual activity, it actually becomes much more attractive for people to be a part of. They feel like they're helping you build something and that they are a part of it. They take on ownership. So looking at the idea of screen captures, many of us now have become familiar with the idea of book trailers, right? We have movie trailers, come see our lovely movie, always with a deep baritone voice, you know, in a world, right? And now we're seeing book trailers in a world on paper, whatever it is. What about idea trailers? How do you put together that 1 minute piece that really outlines what you want to accomplish in your volunteer initiative, in your different projects, etc.? Put it together so that people have a quick way to refer back to it and to share it with other people who may be involved. You never know where it's going to go. But you want to then take that place on the web and put this foment, put this early formative work so that people truly feel a part of it. I always, you know, when you talk about management philosophies, I sort of have two perspectives. One, you can be extraordinarily crafty, secretive, and political, forming alliances and telling lies where necessary to forward your Machiavellian goals, or you can be completely transparent and open, and I'm not smart enough to be the first. That includes the work that I try and do around ideas, right? You don't want, oh, he's out for himself, oh, you know, he already did this 10 years ago and he's now just trying to get credit for it, what have you. Show the work. Show the disagreements. Show the arguments. Show the discussions that come in where people really don't agree. It's okay. I think a lot of us worry about negative impacts going on Twitter and negative impacts and comments and etc. The problem isn't the negative impact. The problem is when you refuse to engage it or when you stifle that, it will find an out. Preferably, you want to be part of the situation where you can at least address it, where people can disagree, but at least you're having a discussion about the ideas and not ad hominem attacks. So there are plenty of people out there that are not thrilled with the concept of new librarianship. Either they don't feel it's that new, or they don't think that it deals with collections and institutions well, or they don't think it goes far enough. They think that it really we need to talk about revolutionary ways of dismantling an entire power structure and starting from scratch. All of those are really interesting, fascinating conversations. And yes, all of those take me at least 5 minutes to take deep breaths, write out really nasty emails, and delete it before I engage in that conversation. But in all of those conversations, after I do that, I have learned a lot. I've learned more. Every idea I've ever had has only gotten better by sharing it. And I said that once, and people go, oh, but committees make things horrible. You don't have to listen to and agree with everyone, but having the conversation, having people contribute it, makes things much better than if you simply assume you can do it all on your own. So be open in how you do these things. Be open to the community, to your employees, to your sponsors, to your friends, to your faculty, whatever. It's the nature of our field to be open and build those collections in a collaborative way. We need to make sure that we are comfortable doing that with our own work and not just other people's work. So back to the expect more example of it. This is my blog, and if you go, you can search on just everything. It's about expect more. And so just really quickly, there's a presentation. There is an event that was occurring. At the bottom, there's a blog post about how different materials fit together. The idea is that they're conversations, that those comment areas are open. For this particular book that happens to be on the screen, we'll talk about in a moment, but we put together community forums where we had people come and talk and argue about different ideas and where they fit and don't fit. By the time that publication has occurred, people are looking forward to that because they know it's coming. They feel like they've had some contribution to it, or they're looking forward to tearing it apart, whichever. It all works for me. That idea of making the community come forward, having a place where they can have an archive and they can have a voice. So we've talked about building linkable ideas. We've talked about now building collections around those linkable ideas. The next important part is to build a narrative, which is a great idea is a great idea. And a great agenda is a great agenda. But if you can't communicate it and you can't connect it to people's ideas, then it's all in your head. Or it's exclusionary to only those people who speak your language. Narratives are essential. Wendy Newman at the University of Toronto does a brilliant work around advocacy. And this is an idea that I have learned from her. And that's the notion that a narrative is something that really takes someone somewhere. As humans, we sort of want the story. We want the narrative arc from the beginning to the middle to the end, to talk about successes along the way and milestones. And so that idea of how do we tell that narrative and the importance of narrative is central to building these movements. Tell stories. Right? It's not enough to say, well, if we have volunteers coming in and if we use them as guides and hosts to public programming versus shelving, things will be better. Okay. But that's different than saying, let me tell you about Beverly. Beverly came in here and Beverly had a lot of background in art. And we told her, why don't you have a painting day in the public library? And it turns out that the first one, 3 people showed up. But after talking about it and going out in the community, suddenly 5 people and 8 people and 20 people are showing up. And last Thursday, we had 20 people in our library with watercolor paints doing this amazing work. That's much more interesting than going, we had a volunteer, we brought them in, we had them do a painting session and 20 people showed up. What's the narrative? What's your story? How do people get involved with it? Every presentation you give, whether that's an elevator speech in 3 minutes, 30 seconds, whether that's at a conference, whether that's at your meetings, whatever it is, every chance you have should start with a story, should be a narrative. Don't assume that people are where you are. Think in tweets. Now, Twitter can be, and I used to recommend people get on social media and Twitter. These days, frankly, it's such a brutal environment, I don't recommend students and other folks being part of it just because it can be an abusive environment. But the concept of distilling down complex ideas to 140 plus characters is not a bad concept. Sometimes you can't do it. We used to talk about one pagers, and now we're down to 140 characters. It's not to get the nuance and the specialties and the unique parts of that idea, but it is to quickly distill it to get people's attention. Be willing and work really hard to get small sentences. I'll give you an example. Example, I am now at the University of South Carolina. It is lovely. I am at the School of Library and Information Science. It is lovely. We have a master's program that may have folks out there have come through or familiar with. Hello, alums. We also have an undergraduate program. Currently, our undergraduate program has about 40 students in it. We want to get it up to 300. That's my current worry. And at Syracuse, we had the same thing. We had an undergraduate population, currently about 700 students, but it started really small. And every place that I've been that has just started an undergraduate program has the same problem, which is they know what a librarian does, and they know what the master's program is, but then they look at the undergraduate population, they go, all right, why do we have undergraduates? Because we know an undergraduate degree in library science makes no sense. We need masters. Is this a feeder program? How do we need it? And so we began talking about the narrative. What is it that we want to accomplish? What is it if we had 300 people come in here and got an undergraduate degree from our school, how is society better? And we began saying things like, well, it turns out that not only do we have to prepare great librarians, but we have to prepare the principals who hire them, the mayors, the CIOs who hire them and support them, citizens who go out and have the same values and principles and see librarians as allies. This is a generational problem. If we can talk about taking an entire generation of undergraduate students coming in and teach them the value of privacy, of information organization, of information literacy, and understand the power of librarianship and value the people with the credentials, then in 10 and 20 years, when these people assume mantles of leadership, they will improve the situation for librarians as well. That's a story. then what we began saying is, all right, so what do we teach them? What is it that's unique to library science, the information science, that we can prepare these folks for? And we began looking at it. We get, well, technical skills, but there's computer science over there. And we don't want just people doing desktop support. They're really doing this information life cycle, information seeking. And we kept going, hitting our heads going, well, we know what it is, but I don't know how to tell an 18-year-old in 10 seconds what it is. Until we had a meeting with a bunch of alums and what I call aspirational alums, the people we really wish were our alums. And this one came up to me, he goes, you know what you're doing, this whole discussion, what you really want is geeks with social skills. And I went, yes. In fact, I went and every other faculty member and every other faculty member I've told, including in other departments, that what our information science degree is geeks with social skills, looks at me and goes, well, of course, absolutely. So it's a tweet, right? And this is the back of my, this is the back of my iPad, and I walk around with it everywhere. And trust me, it's beautiful. Now, it doesn't get into the nuances, but if you get crafty and you want to turn that back into an hour-long presentation, I can say in search of, as in searching, because searching is core and information-seeking behaviors, blah, blah, blah. Geeks, because geeks come out of a library tradition where in certain places like computer science, it's seen as a negative attribute, seen as an insult. In ours, in library science, we geek the library. And geeks means someone who has a special passion for and we're cool and hip. And social skills doesn't just mean that they don't drool, but that they understand social science and look, right? So I can break this thing into an hour-long presentation, but I can say, yeah, our information science program, are you a geek with social skills? Come in. And we get people who come across the room to say, what's that mean? And we, you know, do things like we give special dispensations. You know, we have a few spots that we reserve for non-geeks. But that quick distillation suddenly took our undergraduate degree from, well, it's really good, kind of, to something that 18-year-olds, my 16-year-old walks around with his geeks with social skills stuff and t-shirts that we're doing for this program. And now we have everyone that's out there pushing our message for our information science degree. The other thing to talk about as that narrative is that you want to bridge from normal to extraordinary. What I mean is you start with that idea of geeks with social skills, and then you begin talking about, but this is something that we, you know, we really have these skills, and then this generational issue, and they can be working in industry and banking, and we can, right? That turns into a grand. What starts with, we want more 18-year-olds to apply to our program, suddenly becomes, we must do this to save society. Right? And I know that sounds really somewhat probably sleazy, but isn't ultimately what you're trying to do for improving the community that you're seeking to serve? I mean, even something like that, the volunteer program, or even something like improving circulation times or all of these things, isn't it really so that we can save money or save effort so that we can dedicate and devote to smarter communities? Link it to that. You always win when you go big, because I'll tell you, if you start small, we're going to really improve 15 minutes of circulation. The amount of attention and things you're going to get is low. If you talk about how that's going to improve the dynamic and workflow, et cetera, then you really begin to tie into a larger need and a larger inclusion. Fred, did I knock you off? Yeah.
Sorry, we have a question from the audience. And the question is, how can we practice and develop our storytelling skills? Many of us think in more linear ways that may be different from the narrative process.
It's a great question. And what I would argue is that we're in a field that loves narratives, right? So we spend a lot of time reading, identifying, recommending those narratives. And so I think it's as simple as sort of, you know, go spend some time with story time. But it really is that idea of going back to the agenda. If you have the current situation and the anticipated future, you automatically build a narrative, right? It automatically, you have to explain how you get from point A to point B. That's the most basic, simple narrative there is. But we often then do that in our minds and our processes, but we only tell people about where we ended. We need to tell the journey. And so it's a simple, right, if I put this instead of narrative, if I said something to the effect of, you need to demonstrate the progress from the previous to preferred future, then it sounds nice and clinical. And it's the same thing. So practicing the narrative, start with friends and neighbors, start with spouses and parents, whatever it is. And I'll tell you, in library science, the first narrative you probably had to learn on the fly was, you need a master's degree for that? If you were ever a library student that was ever asked, or here's the other one, oh, we still have librarians? Or aren't libraries obsolete? Right? We get defensive and we might want to try and answer that question, but imagine if instead you think of it as a narrative, right? Aren't libraries obsolete? Well, I'll tell you what, if libraries had stayed the same way as they were in 1950, absolutely. But what has happened in libraries, first we began to expand the collections, and then we had reference services and digital materials, and now we're in makerspaces, and now libraries are essential, right? By simply exposing the timeline, you're building a narrative that becomes more compelling than simply, no, libraries are really important because we have makerspaces now, right? That's, I think, the practice, is go back to the basics. Where are you? Where do you want to go? And tell me the steps to get between them. That is a narrative. You can write the narrative. You can speak the narrative. You can put it into a trailer. But as simple as starting with the timeline is how you begin to set up those discussions. Next time you have to give a presentation, don't study something and give us the end of the result. Talk about the research process that you went through. Today I'm going to talk about our new integrated library system. Instead of going, here's feature one, feature two, feature three, start with, the previous one didn't allow us to do this. So we talked with them and we got this new feature that allows us to X. So I think that the short form of it is, setting the narrative may seem like it's an unusual thing to do, but just think of it as exposing process and timeline, because people want to be part of the formation of ideas, not the completion of ideas. They want to benefit from the completion of ideas, but if you need their involvement or help, they need to see the process. And so that's where narrative, timeline, process, we need to expose it. Does that make some sense?
And going along with this, we have another comment from the audience, and she says, Training Magazine has a series of pre-recorded webinars on using storytelling in training. Look on www.trainingmag.com. So Excellent. That's a good resource.
Absolutely. All right, so I got one more. We now know that we have, you know, we have our agenda, we have our linkable ideas, we've begun to build a narrative. What do we need to do now? We built collections, built narratives. What do we do now? We need to build tools. So this is, sorry to sound like a cranky old professor, but there was a fellow by the name of Lewin in the 1950s who was looking at organizational change. And what Lewin discovered was that all these great change initiatives, you would walk into an organization, a big bureaucratic organization, Fortune 500 companies, large urban library, you name it, and someone would come up with a great idea, initiative for change, implement it like crazy, retask all their employees, and they'd come back a year later and they were all doing what they used to do. And what he did is he presented a metaphor that said, you need to think of this as a freezing and unfreezing process. What you have for any business, any organization, non-for-profit, whatever, any organization to get their work done has to be frozen. It has to have a set of workflows, processes, outcomes, and inputs, some systems that it knows how to do very well, that it's optimized, it can crank through, right? So doing the day-to-day is important. But when you want to change that, particularly if you want to fundamentally change it, what you must do is you must unfreeze them. In other words, you must say, all right, you've been doing this for 20 years. Now you need to do something differently. And he says there's two things that you need to unfreeze someone. One, you need an incentive. And librarians, we are fantastic on change from incentives. That is, if we implement makerspaces, if we implement open hours, if we implement 24-hour study time, if we implement liaison programs, then life will be wonderful. People will sing our glory and every day they will fall at our feet. We love that. And Lewin would say, good start. Says the other thing you need, and this is the part we don't like doing, is you need the stick. You need to make them uncomfortable with where they are now. Not only where you want them to go, but to say, if you don't go there, things will be bad. Not very personal, you'll be fired, but the idea that if we don't go there, our gate counts are going to go down, our funding's going to go down, we're not going to be able to serve the people we know we need to serve, right? So you need both of those to unfreeze. And he said, but the last step is the one most people forget, which is you need to re-freeze them. That is, go back to where we started, which is a functioning organization has a set of workflows, processes, and systems that they know how to crank through very quickly and efficiently. You need to create those ruts for people to get into. As an example, if you talk about, all right, we used to be very collection-oriented, now we're going to be community-oriented. Okay, every year I have an annual evaluation. Did the form change from the previous to the current way of doing it? Do you have, what criteria are we going to use to judge whether I'm community-oriented enough? That idea of, okay, that's great. How do we get job descriptions that use that language? How do we build it into our HR system? We have a policy that says that if we are not at our desk at 9 o'clock in the morning, we get docked pay, but you want me to be at a train station across town engaging people, that policy needs to change. Right? So the point of this is, if we want, as we begin to move people through this change process, through to our preferred future, bringing them along, what we need to do is we need to give them very concrete tools by which they can implement, utilize, or evangelize our ideas. Standards, right? The MARC standard. We needed something to come and say, it's got to be this field and that field and this field. As we've moved to open data, we're all scrambling around to look for what is the equivalent, right? What is the equivalent of the manual that tells me how to do RDA? What is the equivalent of, right? I need the new norm. Associations and groups. I need a place to go talk about this. I need a community. I need an event. I talk about what I call the crazy ideas list. I have a list of people in my life that I encounter, and I sort of every time I meet them say, are you all right if I send you crazy ideas every so often? And they usually love them, right? You say, I had this great idea for a, you know, an awesome conference that's on a cruise to Hawaii, right? And you send it by these people and they usually say, that's a great idea. But oftentimes they might say, that's great, but if I try and get that funded in my organization, it's going to get slapped down. But the idea is that as you meet people that you think are interesting, how to exchange ideas, may have resources, constantly prime the pump to connect that network. I mean, we talk about, you know, in human resources and in librarianship, we talk about networks all the time, human networks. The trick with a human network is not just do you have a bunch of business cards, not just can you talk to them in a conference, but are you regularly supplying them something to think about? Because what I have found is directors of libraries, people within large government organizations, business organizations, they're used to people calling up and saying, hey, do you have money? Do you have time? What they really love is, hey, what do you think about? The minute you ask someone, and particularly in a bureaucratic organization, about the quality of their thinking, they tend to be more engaged. If they're not, they don't want to think, they're off your list. But those folks become really powerful in sharing them. Some others, software. Back in the days of virtual reference, we created software so people could ask and answer questions. Virtual reference would not be where it was today had the Library of Congress not sat down and come up with their CDRS and question point from OCLC and et cetera. Books, events, right? So when I have these great ideas about community-oriented librarianship and et cetera, these books all have a story to tell as tools to bring people along, right? The Atlas, if you know about it, is this sort of sprawling, very pointed, though there's now a soft cover version. But it's a little hard to engage. It's a relatively non-linear piece, but it helps in academia, and that was great. But what came out of that is people saying, well, I love these ideas, Dave, but I need to talk to my board member, my provost, my principal, my what have you. And so I said, oh, we need something for the common man, you know, the everyday folk. And that was this Expect More book. So it was very deliberate tool so that as people who joined the movement of community-oriented librarianship could say, oh, now I have something for me and I have something for my community. What started happening is that many people started having librarians and library science students read Expect More, because at one point it was free. And what we went back is we said, oh, we need something for the practitioner that's not quite as stream of consciousness as the Atlas, as easy and preferably as cheap as Expect More. And so we worked with MIT Press to come up with this new librarianship field guide. So this is these three volumes. People say, oh, you're an academic. This is to put on your CV and get tenure and such. No. Each one of these had a specific audience that I could use this tool to bring people into the idea, to start the discussion, to get them sold on, and each one had a different purpose. One was from MIT Press because that was prestigious, it got my academic friends. One was self-published and cheap because it could be easily sent out en masse to the public. And one, the New Librarianship Guide, is still $22 in paperback. MIT didn't like that. They wanted to do a nice hardbound book, but it was so that we can get library science students because it became cheap for adoption in library science programs and for practitioners. Each one of these is a tool that had a strategy behind it to engage communities. Last thing I'll do, because I'm sorry I'm taking up so much time, and we're going to put the slides up. So I threw this one at the end to try and sort of make this as a summative system. So just a quick handout, if you will, about what we're trying to build. Linkable ideas, collections, narratives, tools. What do I mean by those? Give me some specific examples and, you know, specifics on that, and then some examples. And you'll see at the bottom a big thing that says draft, 9/14/16, brainstorm, open to suggestions, right? So I take this, I've created content, I put it on the web in a linkable way. It has a narrative, this story, so people know what it's going, and this is the tool that came out of it, and it's linkable in the sense that I'm open to suggestions, so I want people to participate in it. So it really is about how do we pull this in? And the goal here is when I sit down to talk about taking over the world and building an empire, which, by the way, I do on a regular basis, it's all around, okay, what do we want to get? What's the impact? Let's work through how to make this linkable. What's the collection? What's the narrative? What are the tools? And we just begin churning to these ideas that we can communicate. Who are we communicating it to, et cetera. All right, so that was a lot of me rambling on. Questions, thoughts, comments, disagreements, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, we've got a few questions, and I just want to encourage people to we don't have a lot of time, but please type your questions in now. Could you please talk more about getting staff on board? Some staff have a revulsion of anything new, anything that represents change. Do you need to be a therapist to figure out how to find the link within them that can get them to participate?
Two ideas. One, therapy is actually a fair amount of the job of an administrator and supervisor. I can't tell you the power of simply sitting and listening for a change. Staff suddenly like that. The other is that many staff, you know, I have a bias, and I talk about bias a lot. I have a bias that people actually act rationally. As much as we don't think so. And so a lot of resistant staff are resistant because they've seen lots of good ideas come and go and they've realized they can outweigh them. And so that idea of assuming that they don't want to change just because they don't want to change or they're obstinate or aren't they reasonable or aren't they logical, oftentimes they're very logical and reasonable and they just look at your idea and say, I can outweigh this, not because I don't want to change, but because you're going to ask me to change again and again and again and again. And there's not a big reward system here. So, and there's the Lewin stuff I talked about. But the most powerful mechanism I have for bringing resistant staff on board is actually the narrative. And what you need to do is you need to link from what people are doing now to what you want them to do. And you need to walk them through that process. So, for example, when I talk about the idea of using community expertise to offer programming within a public library context, you will hear me often use the word collection development. Why do I say that the community is the collection? Because collection is a commonly understood metaphor by even the most diehard traditional old school librarian ever. They get collection. And then I can talk about collection development. And then I can talk about collection optimization. And then I can talk about the idea of organizing the collection and hybrid collections and how technicals, right? That's a narrative that I'm starting with. A library is about books. We had I'll be quicker. The local paper here in Columbia did a thing about how the public library in Columbia is renovating. And yes, they're losing a few books. And in there's a quote that the director gives that she says, libraries are for people. And online, someone wrote, wrong, Melanie, who's, by the way, brilliant. Wrong, Melanie, books or libraries are for books and materials. And all I wanted to say was ... that are for people. It was just like, take that thought a little further. That's the idea of starting where people are and building the narrative to where you want them to go. I've found an amazing positive reaction when people realize you are not devaluing what they are doing or used to do, but you are using it as a platform for doing something even better moving forward. That's where narratives come back into it.
Okay, we have another question. What is the impact of staying in the half-frozen slush zone?
Lewin would tell you that the slush zone, what you end up with is a lack of optimization. Now, remember the context that he was speaking of, this is all around bureaucracy and making things efficient. And I would argue that librarianship as a field since Melville Dewey has suffered from a fixation on efficiency, that we standardized everything not because it was necessarily more effective, but it was certainly more efficient. I like the half slush zone. But it depends on where you want people's creativity and imagination. The problem isn't that everything has to be well formed. The problem is you don't want them focusing on things that don't matter for the change. Long story short, if we want academic faculty to teach better in their classroom, the last thing we want them to worry about is, oh, by the way, we're changing your resource and your health insurance plans, right? That creates an anxiety where you want them to be experimenting and playing, trying new things over here, but because you haven't frozen basic things that you don't want to mess with, like HR policies and hours of operation, et cetera, then they can't concentrate on what you want them to do. So the short answer is, in a given area, it can be a point of great creativity, not efficient, but very effective. But it can't be universally applied. We live our lives. You woke up this morning and you assumed that you had a job. You assumed that you were going to get to the job the same way you always did, bus, car, walk, what have you. If you couldn't even assume that that was available, if it was a national, you know, in Columbia we had massive flooding that took out roads, you're not going to be efficient at your job if you're worried about flooding in your home and you can't get to work. So the answer isn't to look globally at everything must be frozen and everything must be, or everything must be in this interstitial state. The idea is you want to freeze what works and what, you know, where you want efficiency, and you want to move people and change to be very targeted and specific to where you want innovation.
Okay, I think we just have time for one more question. So let's see. What if the preferred future does not align well with or is unrealistic to the assets at hand, especially staff assets, skills, abilities, etc.?
Well, so this is where the preferred future may be really, really, really far away from the anticipated future, and you have two choices. Either you need to lower your expectations for your preferred future, or you need to extend the timeline in which you're working. And I think that all too often, we feel that every order of every magnitude, every type of change has to occur within a 12-month planning cycle or a 5-year planning cycle, which is ridiculous. So really, it's a matter of that agenda side. It's not that, you know, you give me, you know, given enough time, I can do anything. Working your agenda back and then constantly revising and revisiting your agenda to see what's happening. And if you're clear about it and you make those milestones really transparent back to that open effort, you might be surprised that the resources that you didn't think could change, suddenly you can begin to get them to buy in, staffing resources, financial resources, etc. So setting yourself a totally unrealistic, disconnected from reality goal, not a good idea. But having that understanding that that gap between your anticipated future and your preferred future, if it's really big, start moving it on the timeline versus scaling back what you want to get done. When I started virtual reference work back in the very early 90s, people thought you couldn't answer questions online. People were doing email. There was no such thing as the web. And the idea that any teacher in any classroom anywhere in the world could ask a question of an educational expert seemed like it was bogglingly impossible. Today, that's Facebook, right? So yeah. It took us 15 years, took us 20-some years, but we did it. And it started by having that large vision and then constantly revisiting and seeing where were those intermediate steps.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we're out of time, which is a shame. We have quite a few more questions. But, Dave, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to give this presentation and talk with us today. And do you have any final words for our audience?
Just that once again, I think that we are in the right field to make the right impact in society, and it's going to come from us having a preferred future and understanding that our job is to change the present to identify that future. So I think we're all sick of hearing what the future of libraries are. I think we're all really need to spend a lot of time on what we want the future of libraries to be and what we can make happen. So there you go. Thanks so much for your time. I do appreciate it.